Well, there are many times in history that seem darker than others. If you think about the children of Israel, when they spent 430 years in Egypt, most of those years were in slavery. And you think, 400 years of slavery? Oppression? We have a hard time imagining a day or a week, let alone a year or multiplied years, 400 years. That was a dark time. And the Lord brought them out, but it wasn't exactly an easy removal in many ways because there were obstacles that needed to be dealt with. And then you think about what we had talked about when we were going through the book of Isaiah. The nation of Israel being taken captive, first the southern kingdom, and then, or the northern kingdom, and then the southern kingdom. And you think about, why would they have to go through that kind of trial and tribulation for that length of time? And you think about the Jewish people throughout the years since then, and the difficulties, and the dark times, in various places, at various times, we think particularly of the Holocaust. And we think, why would the Lord allow His people to go through those kinds of circumstances? And we think about the church age that we are in, and the different times of persecution and difficulties that were there, that people have had to deal with and continue to deal with in various parts of the world today, as the presentation is going to be communicating on Friday evening that Pat is going to be directing. There have been many dark times in many difficult places, and we wonder, why does the Lord allow that kind of thing to happen? And we think about the times that we're in, and we wonder, why are we having to deal with these kinds of things? We've had a tough week, legislatively, things that have passed that we wonder, why would the Lord allow that? That's just absolutely antithetical to biblical thinking and biblical truth. But we also have read scripture that tell us that there's times coming that are going to be even more difficult after the church is raptured, and probably leading up to that, that we'll have to deal with. And so I think these are times where we will have opportunity, if you want to call it that, to reevaluate our own lives. What are we all about? Why are we here? And why would the Lord allow us or cause us, as the case may be, to have to deal with these kinds of things, as He has done throughout history in the past? Well, this is also a time for us to watch for the hand of God at work among us. And that's what we'll be watching for as we look at the passage that's before us today. And we're going to, first of all, kind of go somewhat of an overview of this passage, verses 24 to 49, and then the next time we come back, we'll focus on the content of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. But for today, we want to look at the overall picture of what was going on, and the circumstances, and how things unfolded, and what we can learn about that as it relates to Daniel being in a, and his friends being in a very precarious situation, and yet seeing God intervening and providing and communicating through the process. So we want to think about the practical value of taking initiative as needed. Well, and we are living in a world where we may have occasion where we'll need to take initiative as needed in order to continue to function in the context that we find ourselves in. We need to know when to act, how to act, what we ought to do when the pressure is on us, as Daniel is having to deal with as well. So looking at verses 24 and 25, we read, "Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, and he had previously had some contact because Arioch had come, because Arioch's responsibility was to extinguish all of the wise men because they weren't able to come up with what the king was demanding. So therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, 'I have found a man of the captives of Judah.'" Well, he sort of found him, but actually Daniel found him. But we understand he's wanting to get credit wherever he can. "Who will make known to the king the interpretation?" Now, that was a bit of a brave statement, because how did he know that Daniel was going to pull it off, other than that Daniel told him that? But did he have good reason to believe that? So Daniel has the information that is being requested. What we want to recognize is that divine knowledge does not function in isolation. When God gives his truth, it is in context. And all of Scripture was given in various contexts as well. And we can relate and understand that that is the case. And it's helpful for us to realize that. And so the scripture that we're looking at right now was given in a particular context as well. Arioch was in a position of authority with a specific purpose. His mission was to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Imagine being in that position, having that responsibility. There are times when there are people who have authority and responsibility that they need to follow through, and I'm sure it's not always easy to do, because it's not an easy thing to deal with people in that kind of way. Well, this would certainly have been a difficult task. It was clear all he had to do was kill these numbers of people, and that's what his task was. And he was not expected to distinguish or discriminate among them. So it's not an easy situation. Then we see Daniel also sought out Arioch to indicate his knowledge of the dream. And so in the previous verses, Daniel is praising the Lord for providing that information. So Daniel then looks to see where he needs to go to communicate this. And so he determined who it was that he needed to deal with. So he went to Arioch, and he indicated that he had the knowledge that was needed. And I'm not sure how he went about convincing Arioch that he actually had it. What was it about Daniel's communication? That's interesting to think about. We live in a world of a lot of fake news. How did Arioch know that Daniel actually had the truth? Was he just making it up? So that's an interesting observation as well. So apparently he had sufficient confidence in Daniel to approach the king, because you don't just go show up at with the king and without having a good reason and without having what the king wants. He was at risk of being killed if Daniel did not deliver. You don't say, "Hey, I've got the answer," and then Daniel can't pull through. So he was really dependent on him. And he indicated that Daniel will make known the interpretation. He didn't say he might, he said he will. So there was an element of confidence there, because there's always a chance that the king could react in some unexpected way, because he has already shown himself to be a bit capricious and temperamental, and the king was rather urgent to know the answer. So what we have observed as with this king, is that most rulers are focused on their own position, maintaining their position and their power, and politics hasn't changed much. It's still very much that same way. They want to maintain what they have or gain more. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar was already in the process of doing that. Then looking at verses 26 through 28, the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, and that would have been the name that he would have used in the king's presence, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. He's preparing a contrast here. He says, but there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. And then he's going to go into them. But let's just make a couple of notes here. Divine plans involve coordinating many working parts. Now, this was, you kind of have to look at this and say, well, the Lord is working all of this out. And there are many details that are involved. And when we see things happening in our world today, we need to be recognizing that there are many things that are happening that we may not see how they're all fitting together until after it has transpired, and then we might be able to look back and say, oh, the Lord has been working. Look at how he's brought these things together. I'm sure you've seen that in your own experience, where you see things happen, and it don't happen the way you think they ought to be happening, and yet they happen this way, and then you look back and say, oh, I see the Lord was working in this way to bring this to pass or to get me to this place or to get me to think this way. And so we need to recognize that there's a coordination of very many different things. The king asked if Daniel could in fact give the dream and its interpretation. He had been disappointed in the past. He had been told by the Chaldeans that what you're asking is too much. We can't do it. And so the king wanted real answers to his questions. He didn't want somebody just making something up. And there's some suspicion that that Nebuchadnezzar questioned the legitimacy of these soothsayers, these magicians and all of that. And maybe he was testing them to find out if they were for real or not, whether he could depend on them or not. Maybe this was all part of the test, or maybe it wasn't quite that dramatically intentional, but it could be. So Daniel here is, again, recognizing his Babylonian name and recognizing that the king didn't want to be wasting his time. He wanted the truth. And there's often a great amount of effort involved in getting to the truth. Now, in our present day, we are having a serious crisis of truth. There's so much information out there. How do you know what's true? How do you know what's right? When you look at all of the different input that's out there, coming from the right, coming from the left, some many times in between somewhere, how do you know what is right and true? That's something we have to very carefully deal with and evaluate and vet on many occasions because there's fake news on every side, and we need to be careful about that. Daniel indicated that no man could give the dream and its interpretation. This was supernaturally originated, and it's not something that any man could come up with. No wise man of any time could give what the king demanded. They don't have the wherewithal because this was something that the Lord had originated. So this was in a sense, a cover for these other wise men, saying that it's not something they could even do, but it was also an exposure to say, hey, even if they tell you they can do it, they can't, because they probably, in fact, pretty much had claimed that that's what they could do. They could get information from the gods, and then they would make up stuff. You tell me the dream, and I'll come up with whatever sounds good. So there's another name that's used in this listing here, diviners. These were astrologers that tried to draw information about the future from the heavens. And God here is referred to as the God of heavens, as the one who had in fact revealed the mystery. So there's a little bit of a play on the individuals that are referenced here. And then it specifically was dealing with information about the end of the days that God is giving to Daniel to pass on to Nebuchadnezzar. And this phrase was first used in Genesis 49:1, and always refers to the future, things that are yet to take place. And so this is an acknowledgement that this is something that God is revealing through Daniel to King Nebuchadnezzar that has implications for King Nebuchadnezzar, but also for the whole world. And it's going to, most of the things that are dealt with have something to do with the anticipation of the Messiah's appearance in the future, because that's the bigger picture. And most things have some connection to that, as we'll see that is the case here as well. One commentator said this, in the context of Daniel 2, the latter days include all the visions which Nebuchadnezzar received and stretches from 600 BC to the second coming of Christ to the earth. So this vision that's, or this dream that's given is very broad in its scope. And what he points out here is these men are not able to give the answer, but he's giving a contrast because only the Lord is able to give this because it came from him. And so what this is saying is this is a situation that is bigger than you are, Nebuchadnezzar. It's bigger than all of them. It's something that goes way beyond them. And I can't help but think when we see stuff going on today that we need to recognize that this is bigger than what we can see on the surface. The things that are going on today have larger implications. And that's why we keep coming back to the reality that this is spiritual warfare that's going on. This is the forces of good versus the forces of evil in the broadest extent. And we need to remember that these are big things that are going on in the background. And then Daniel indicated the true source of the dream and its interpretation. It involves something that God wanted to reveal about the latter days, and only God could reveal it because this came from him. And he wanted this king to know at this time in this way. And that's significant. It's not incidental. It's not accidental. It's divine design. And it's a recognition of God's hand at work in history. And it's an indication that in spite of how much power and authority and influence that Nebuchadnezzar had, he was not the ultimate. Now, how many people in authority want to be told that they're not the ultimate authority? It doesn't go over very well. But we need to remember that when we see people exercising authority like they have absolute authority, we know better. In 1936, the German Nazi Reichstag, their parliament, passed a law investing the Gestapo secret police with absolute authority, exempt from any legal review. And Hitler used the occasion of the burning of the Reichstag as a claim for a crisis. He blamed it on the communists, and he used that to take away all civil rights. We need to recognize how things go and be careful and not just assume that it's an innocent move there is danger, and we don't want that to happen again, and we need to be prepared for that. Because we know, as Lord Acton said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And these folks, while they want to wield power, they do not have absolute power. But in as much as they try to claim it and try to use it, they are a great danger. But this, again, is a reminder. God is in control, not mankind. Although they have obviously some influence and they have some impact, but it's not ultimate. Looking at verses 29 and 30, we read, "As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and who reveals secrets, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me," now notice the contrast there, "as for you, as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for the sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart." So we see divine thoughts are communicated through selected persons. And that's helpful for us to realize that the Lord deals directly with a very select number of people historically. And it is very intentional, specific people at specific times for a specific purpose. If you think you are the one to receive direct divine communication, you might want to think again. He has given us his word, and we can trust that. Daniel indicated that God was revealing secrets of what will take place in the future, of those things that will be. And so this dream is by divine design. It was not from too much pizza the night before. Now, I don't know if they had pizza back then. They probably had something similar because pizza, as everyone knows, is the universal meal for everyone, right? Just ask any kids. They'll tell you. Pizza. But whatever it was not from what he ate. It was a divine appointment. And Daniel reminded Nebuchadnezzar that before he had fallen asleep, he had been thinking about the future. That's part of how this was worked out. The dream that God had given him was a divine revelation of what the future would hold. One commentator said, "No dream recorded or referred to in the Bible before this or since has ever revealed so much of world history." And that's interesting because it gives a big picture of what is coming to pass. But what we want to recognize is that this king was specifically selected for this revelation. Why King Nebuchadnezzar? Well, he was one of the top dogs of the time. He was probably the big guy. He exercised influence. But he was also the first of the rulers throughout the times of the Gentiles of a significant nature. And this was a major historical event that was unfolding. And Daniel indicated that his part was purely instrumental. He was a servant of the Lord. It wasn't because he was brilliant, because he had any particular special knowledge in and of himself. It was because he was rightly related to the master of the universe. And that's the key thing. And he knew his place, and he recognized that. He didn't initiate the communication. He was a vehicle for the communication of it in a special way. And this revelation was for the benefit of all who would hear it. Daniel recognized that he was an instrument in the Lord's hands, and he was a means through which God was accomplishing his will at that present time. And we need to recognize that God can use us as we are submissive instruments in his hands as well. Now, we don't need to assume that, well, we're going to interpret someone's dream for them, and it'll be just exactly like that. It's a matter of one who is submissive to the Lord and desiring to be his servant and to accomplish his will. And then the Lord can use us. We have his revelation. We have been given it. We don't have to get a dream, but we can communicate it. We can share it. We can understand it by giving attention to it and studying it. And then we can utilize it. And in that sense, we can be like Daniel. Then we come to the second portion here of this text, and we see the divine revelation and interpretation of the dream. And we're going to go through this maybe a little bit more quickly because we're going to come back to this in a couple of weeks. So looking at verses 31 through 33, what I want to accomplish here is to get an overview of what is taking place and what is kind of involved here. It says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." So this is the second part. The first part is just what the image looks like. The second part is there's something that's going to happen to that image. Verse 35, "Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king." So just a quick couple of observations here. First, we will only identify the imagery at this point. Identify what is involved here. And we want to consider the circumstances around the giving of the prophecy, but not focus on the prophecy itself. The image of four distinct parts is identified. And there's ultimately going to be four kingdoms that are identified, and then there's going to be a fifth one that we'll see. The image is effectively destroyed by a specifically identified and unique stone. And so the image and its interpretation will have great prophetic significance, as we'll see soon. Verses 37 through 40. "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." What's the operative word in that sentence? Given you, that God has given you what you have. You have a lot of power and strength and glory. You have this kingdom, but it was given to you. Now, how many people recognize today that what they have is from the Lord when they find themselves in power? Just to throw this out, how many governors of our states recognize that they are in power because the Lord allowed them to be there? Good question. "And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the air, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them. You are this head of gold. And after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others." Then verses 41 to 43. "Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet are partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, and they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. So that's the interpretation of the dream that's given. The parts of the image related to the present and future kingdoms. So there's an identification that this is something historical that you need to recognize. And the kingdoms are of different levels of strength and influence, and that is pointed out by the coloration and the item, what they're made out of, and so on. And then the fourth kingdom will be a mixture of strength and brittleness, and that will have implications as well. So these are kingdoms that will progress in history through the particular region of the known world for the most part at that time, and they will succeed one another, and there will be varying degrees of effectiveness and impact that they will have. Then looking at verses 44 to 45, and in these days, or in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now that's pretty major stuff that he's communicating there. That's a pretty big statement that we'll be looking at. Inasmuch as you saw the stone, that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So, take it seriously, is what he's saying. So the Lord indicated the divine implications of the dream. The God of heaven will establish a kingdom that will dominate the world and last forever. And, of course, the church age fits in between the scenario here of the Messiah's first and second coming that we recognize and want to acknowledge. This kingdom arrangement will surely come to pass and is being revealed at this time. And so this is now being revealed to King Nebuchadnezzar because he is the first in line of succession of what's going on here. And it's also communicated to the world through what Daniel gives at that time, but also has been passed on to us as well. And so there's information that's given here that we want to recognize, that we want to see, okay, what does this have to do with? It has significance as to timing and the audience that is involved, and has to do with the beginning of the times of the Gentiles. And it's the unfolding of God's prophetic plan for the future. And what we need to remember here, and I don't know how many of you have use the cameras that didn't come on your phone, you know, where you could adjust the zoom on the lens. Well, we oftentimes are so zoomed in, so close, that we see things up close and we're overwhelmed by what we see. We're just focused on one little thing, what's going on before us at the moment. And what we're reminded of is you need to step back. You need to kind of go to a wide-angle lens and see the bigger picture, see what God is doing. That's what this is right here. This is zooming out to get the bigger picture. And that's what we'll want to do when we come back to this. Then, the last section here, responses to the revelation and interpretation of the dream. Verses 46 and 47 say, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Now, that's an interesting thing for this king to do. This guy who has been indicated as basically being the top dog of all kings at the time. The king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Now, that's quite an admission. And the question that we would have is, how much of that really was coming from a sincere heart? Or was he saying this, or was it sort of a momentary acknowledgement? Because there are other things that are going to be happening in the future that you kind of wonder, was he really buying into this? He at least acknowledged it. Like, this is a big deal to start with. Well, it's important to recognize the true source of power. That's what seems to be the case here. The king had to face the reality of a higher power. Now, today, there are a lot of folks who don't want anything to do with an acknowledgement of a higher power, of someone who is above and beyond us. But we need to recognize human powers are not ultimate. And so he responded in a way that seemed appropriate to him at the time. Physical obeisance, he fell on his face. Daniel had done something that everyone considered humanly impossible. Daniel had even told him that this is humanly impossible. No man can do this. Only God can. And he told the king the dream that only he knew, except for the Lord, because he gave it to him. And maybe he had even forgotten. We don't know that for sure, or whether he was just trying to get something from the individuals he was dealing with there. And then Daniel gave the interpretation, and that interpretation made sense. It fit. It seemed to be accepted. And so Nebuchadnezzar concluded that Daniel must be some sort of god or his representative, and began to treat him in the way that one would assume to do that. Now, how much of an acknowledgement that Nebuchadnezzar had of other gods, we may not have a real clear understanding of, but it would have been normal to have a formal acknowledgement of this sort. And so the presenting of an offering and the burning of incense to Daniel would have seemed normal to him, the appropriate thing to do. And so he commanded this formal respect to be shown to Daniel. Was it appropriate? Well, really, Daniel wasn't deserving of it. Daniel didn't need it. But that would have been a common way to respond. And what we might ask, well, why didn't Daniel react in horror like the Apostle Paul and Barnabas did in Acts 13 and 14, I think it was 14, when the folks in Asia Minor were responding to Paul and were wanting to worship him. Why didn't he do that? Well, I think Daniel recognized that he was in no position to contradict this misguided monarch who had absolute authority. You don't necessarily say, no, king, don't do that, since he had just gotten through not being killed and wasn't eager to have that happen. So that seems to be perhaps an understanding of why that was, because you're dealing with a rather volatile and powerful leader. The question that we would have today is, how many recognize the true source of power, the true God of the universe? Some days I wonder if we recognize that. We think we're handling things pretty well. We may think, maybe I don't need him. But then we have to come to terms with the reality. And there are many, probably most, in our world today who do not have that acknowledgement. So the king formally acknowledged Daniel's God. And I'll note it that way because it's uncertain as to whether he really acknowledged him as the God of the universe. He at least gave the impression that he recognized that he was dealing with the ultimate God of gods. He stated it that way. How much of that did he take to heart? Did he actually believe that? How strong of an impact did that have on him? I think it kind of depends somewhat on how troubled he was about the dream. And did he recognize that the dream came from God? And if that were the case, it might be a little bit more of an acknowledgement. And he may be like many who sometimes acknowledge that God is God and other times don't really think about it too much or don't really take it to heart. And there is that hazard that we all have to deal with to some degree or another. So at least temporarily, he seems to have acknowledged that there was someone bigger than him and his kingdom. But he did refer to God as your God to Daniel, and he didn't indicate it as his God or necessarily even as the true God, but there may have been some acknowledgement in that regard. But he certainly recognized that Daniel was in touch with this God, whether he saw it in a strictly monotheistic sense or just another God out there among the gods, that's perhaps debatable. Then looking at verses 48 and 49, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Now that's quite a promotion. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. It's helpful to see God working behind the scenes, and that's what we want to acknowledge as we look at these final verses. Now, the king responded by promoting Daniel in his kingdom. Daniel was given gifts, given great administrative responsibilities, which would be highly unusual for a non-Babylonian captive to be given that kind of responsibility. But it kind of reminds us of back in the days when Joseph was sold in Egypt and he became second in command as well. So we know that kind of thing can happen. And it is because God is working behind the scenes, because it's not a normal kind of situation. But it does indicate that the king had the highest respect and honor for Daniel. And I'm sure Daniel was probably amazed at what was taking place, and certainly was something beyond his wildest dreams. I'm sure Daniel didn't sit around as a kid thinking, I think I'm going to be second in command somewhere, the biggest kingdom in this earth. I mean, there are some people that may think that way, but I don't think he was one of them. Because that kind of thing just doesn't happen unless God is at work making something like that come to pass. And that's what this was. And I think Daniel had a realization that God was up to something. By this time, seeing everything that's coming to pass, I think he recognized that he wasn't just lucky. It wasn't just his lucky day. God was at work, and he was doing it for the sake of his people, not doing it just for Daniel, but for a bigger thing that he had going on, which is a very important thing to recognize. And then Daniel used the occasion to request promotion for his friends. Now, was this just an opportunistic kind of thing where he thought, hey, as long as I've got this in with the king, let me just see what else I can do for my buddies here? Is that what this was about? Or did he see this is an opportunity for God to put his people in positions of responsibility in a kingdom that would otherwise have been more hostile to his people and for the plans that he has yet in the future? So I think Daniel is recognizing the hand of God is at work, and he's providing for his people who are in exile for these 70 years, and he's going to have a cushion for them, in a sense, to make it more easy or functional to bring about what he ultimately wants to bring to pass, which is working toward what's going to happen with Cyrus in the future when the people are able to go back. But what we need to remember is that God is still able to do that today. Doesn't God have people in places of authority today? And you're thinking, I don't see much evidence of that, but I think it's true. We'd like to see more, but we have people that are working behind the scenes in many places, in many ways, and we need to continue to pray for them. And we want to do all that we can to bring about good where we can, that where we have the opportunity to do so. And we know that in this case, it was a matter of God allowing the Gentiles to have authority and basically be running the show, so to speak, because God had plans for the future. And I can't help but think what we see going on today is God has a plan. He's bringing things to pass. Why did he allow a conservative to be the president for the last previous 4 years? And now a liberal to be the president and to kind of counteract most of what had been done. Why is that happening? Well, we may not see yet, but we may see in the future. So let's not give up hope. This is still the times of the Gentiles. We're still in that. And there's much that has yet to take place. God allows pagans to ruthlessly rule for a time and for a purpose. And we don't want to forget that, because that is still the case. So we don't want to abandon hope when we see these difficult circumstances, these dark days. We need to be careful to see God is still at work. His hand is still in the process. He may be working behind the scenes. He may be working in ways that we can't see. And he often works through individuals who are going through difficult times. I think of the presentation that's going to be shown on Friday night that Pat is going to be coordinating. It's a reminder, through the difficult times, great things can happen. And I anticipate that's the case now. And I think we ought to be encouraged, because that's when people start waking up and recognize the seriousness of what we're up against. And we need that, and we need to see that that's the case. Because otherwise, when things are going easy, we just sort of kick back and relax. But when things get difficult, then we kind of start paying attention. And that's what we need to be doing at this time as well. And it's not a time to cower and hide. It's a time to stand firm for truth, for the communication of the gospel, because that's what's needed. And so it's a time for us to shine and to watch God work behind the scenes in unexpected ways. And he wants to work through us as individuals. So it's not a time for despair. It's a time to rally for the cause of Christ and for his truth, to see his plans come to pass even through us.